I just really believe that the Republican Party has been conned here.
Really? Who's conning who, Senator? We'll discuss.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
No, I'm not.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ and 106.7 FM KSO, in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui, in Ohio on WGRN 94.1 FM in Columbus, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And of course, coast to coast and around the globe as ever, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, Detour Talk in East Tennessee, and Blanketing the Earth. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com, trying and trying to make sense of it all, though I can see it makes no sense at all. Glad you could join us. Good to have you here. Coming up, Harold Meyerson on how Bernie Sanders supporters, at least some of them, are undermining Bernie Sanders and how they will need to support Hillary Clinton, says Harold, if she's ultimately the Democratic Party's nominee, at least if those Bernie Sanders supporters wish to see the agenda of Bernie Sanders and his so-called political revolution move forward beyond the primary election. And mind you, Harold Meyerson is no Hillary supporter in Sanders' clothing, as I've seen from many of the so-called progressives of late, calling for Sanders to drop out, wringing their hands. Oh, it's terrible. It's only helping Donald Trump. I've seen a lot of people, even the progressive sites like Daily Kos and Mother Jones and TPM, are now charging that Sanders staying in the race is going to damage Clinton's chances, Democrats' chances against Trump in the fall. That's what I've been hearing, and that's what I've been reading over the past few days. But if you look at who is making those calls at those so-called progressive outlets, most of them, many of them, are largely folks who have been Hillary Clinton supporters anyway for a long time. Folks like Marcus Melitzis and Josh Marshall and Kevin Drum, people I like, but they're supporters of Hillary. So to hear them say, what happened in Nevada a week or so ago at that convention is just harming Bernie Sanders. He's got to get out right now. Well, anyway, we'll see what Harold Meyerson has to say. He is not one of those progressive Democrats who supports Hillary, and he actually is a Sanders supporter. So I'll be interested in getting his take on all of this. That is coming up. In the meantime, some news from over the weekend, beginning in Bangladesh, where tens of thousands of Bangladeshis have now returned on Monday to wind-battered villages and rain-soaked fields after a strong storm pummeled the coast and killed at least 26 people over the weekend. This is according to AP. Authorities there had ordered about 2 million people to be evacuated from coastal areas before Cyclone Ronu, I believe that's how you say it. Desi Doyen, do you have any idea how that's supposed to be said?
I don't speak Bangladeshi, but I believe that is properly pronounced.
Okay, Ronu or Rowanu, I don't know. That hit that cyclone hit the port city of Chittagong on Saturday. But many had ignored the call to evacuate after deciding that the storm wasn't strong enough. It wasn't such a threat. But tens of thousands spent the weekend in cyclone shelters. Some 100,000 islanders returned on Monday to damaged and flooded homes, many who lost their stored food supplies and are now struggling to find enough to eat. Just a terrible situation. Islanders in Mohishkali are now in constant fear that a 17-mile stretch of mud embankment badly damaged in the storm will collapse and allow seawater to swamp their homes and their fields. Millions are living along the vulnerable coast, and Bangladesh has worked to improve storm preparedness and to issue evacuation orders early to avoid high death tolls. This was much better than what happened in 2007 when Cyclone Sidr hit and about 3,000 were reported killed. The country has now built concrete, raised concrete buildings to serve as cyclone shelters across the vast region, but still, Bangladesh will be increasingly vulnerable as climate change brings stronger storms and rising sea levels, according to experts, that will directly threaten low-lying coastal regions that are home to 160 million people who are densely packed into an area the size of the U.S. state of Wisconsin. So just some of the cost of climate change that continues to ravage the planet and continues to be ignored by and large by the corporate media in this country. Furthermore, we talked last week as this storm was coming in about landslides and heavy flooding in Sri Lanka, specifically mudslides that buried hundreds of families in three different villages. Now that flooding and those mudslides have killed at least 73 people in Sri Lanka, with scores still missing. Hundreds of thousands were forced to flee their homes from the torrential rains that have deluged the island nation since, last weekend, already more than a week. Triggering those huge landslides and burying the victims in up to 50 feet of mud. So they are still trying to work on that situation in Sri Lanka. Soldiers are still looking for bodies in thick mud deposits in a number of districts. Just a terrible situation from the landslides in those three separate villages. 21 people have been confirmed dead and still 123 others are missing. Major General Sudantha Ranasinghe said another part of that same mountain came crashing down on Saturday this weekend, but there were no casualties because residents had already been evacuated after those first landslides. They're trying to get aid out there, but there's just a huge number of people who are dislocated. About 22 of Sri Lanka's 25 districts have been affected by the rains, according to disaster officials. Almost a third of residents have been moved from the low-lying capital, which has a population of some 650,000 people. So the price of climate change-related disasters continues to build around the globe, does it, Doyen?
Oh, it most certainly does. And, of course, we find that you have the biggest populations clustered around the coasts, because that's where the food and the ports are. Mm-hmm. And, unfortunately, as scientists have been predicting for decades, climate change impacts are going to hit the poorest regions of the world first and worst, because they don't have the capacity to deal with the impacts like storm surge from the near-term impacts of climate change. When you have more intense storms, you have changes in the jet stream, which cause these storms to park over locations and continuously dump even more water than they ever had before. And you've got the storm surge, and you have poor construction and shoddy construction that's not prepared for it. Luckily, the Bangladesh officials have been working toward creating better infrastructure and emergency supplies in order to help people survive and recover from these disasters. But this is not a problem that's going to get easier or better with time.
No, it's only getting worse. And it's incredible that we spend so much time on politics in this country. We burn up so much of our media and don't even discuss these things. You know, so many people who are so stressed out about Donald Trump, understandably. But, Donald Trump is a complete climate change denier.
Yeah.
And that issue does not come up. Even on a weekend where you've got these massive cyclones killing people all over the world, it's just not discussed here. It's just not part of our conversation. It's kind of amazing. So that's why I wanted to get that once again up front to make, to help people understand what's actually going on this planet. Because those of us in the U.S., if all you rely on is corporate media, you just have no idea. You have no idea that this went on. it's all about politics now, electoral politics all the time. And that's understandable to some, you know, extent, particularly while the primaries are still going on and a presidential race is ahead. But the fact that it's not even discussed, that these dots aren't even connected, and that these candidates are not even challenged on their positions is remarkable.
And people don't know, because the U.S. corporate media doesn't tell them,
right,
that the Republican majority in Congress,
yep,
is trying to block the United States from actually helping these countries prepare for climate impacts. There is a green climate fund that Obama and the rest of the administration have committed U.S. dollars to helping these countries out. And the Republicans are trying to block that. So elections do matter. It's not just the president that matters. It's also Congress.
Elections do matter. And though we talk about the horse race on this show, I'm sure we spend much more time talking about the track conditions on which those horses are running. So, ironically enough, over the weekend, we had an actual horse race. The Preakness was over the weekend. And here's how AP reported what happened. In the 2 weeks since Nyquist won the Kentucky Derby, his owner, Doug O'Neill, has been rattling off the virtues of his unbeaten star. That's Nyquist. The public bought into it, says Associated Press. Not only was Nyquist the 3-5 odds betting favorite, but there was also a record crowd at the Preakness of some 135,000 people showing up for the second leg of the Triple Crown, the Preakness, over the weekend. That despite miserable weather. Nyquist's owner, O'Neill, insisted on Friday that the rains would not be a factor, but for the first time in 9 career races, Nyquist had to run on a sloppy, muddy track in the Preakness, and for the first time in his career, Nyquist lost. 4 times previously, Nyquist had beat a horse by the name of Exaggerator, ironically enough. But on Sunday, Nyquist lost to Exaggerator. The previously undefeated favorite came in 3rd place thanks to that sloppy, wet, muddy track that they had to run on that served to undermine the odds-on undefeated favorite. I mention that because, as we have been pointing out on this show for years at this point, I don't care how good the candidate is, how undefeated his or her record may be. If the track conditions are muddy, if it's difficult to run, if it's difficult for people to vote, if it's difficult to count those people's votes, anything can happen. And if you've learned anything from this democratic process so far over these past several months, we have very muddy track conditions when it comes to running our elections. Now, back in April, when the Wisconsin was having their presidential primary, and for the first time in a major election, they were using the photo ID voting restrictions that Republicans had put in place out there. You may remember that thousands of students in particular had a very difficult time being able to cast their vote. They had to wait in line for hours. They had to do so twice. They had to wait in line for hours trying to get an ID in the first place. And then just the process of checking those IDs led to really, really long lines just to cast your vote. So thousands of people, thousands of students and minority voters who could not afford to wait in line for hours and hours were not able to cast their vote in Wisconsin. And the fight over that law continues. And that day, as a matter of fact, you may remember this congressman, now a U.S. congressman, Grothman is his name, Glenn Grothman, was asked about the photo ID restrictions that were in place that day, April 5th, I believe it was, for the first time in Wisconsin in a major election. Here's what Republican congressman, former Wisconsin state senator, now U.S. Congressman Glenn Grothman, had to say about Wisconsin's photo ID restriction.
You know that a lot of Republicans since 1984 in the presidential races have not been able to win in Wisconsin. Why would it be any different for a Ted Cruz or a Donald Trump?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up. And now we have photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well.
Mm-hmm. He thinks it's going to make a little bit of a difference as well. By how? By making it harder for Democrats, Democratic-leaning voters, to cast their vote. On that same day, Todd Alba, who had served as chief of staff to a Republican state senator in Wisconsin, he had come out with a piece on Facebook saying that he was in a private caucus meeting when the Wisconsin Republicans first got together and first talked about putting that photo ID restriction in place, and how gleeful Republicans at that meeting, how gleeful they were about the idea of a photo ID restriction keeping Democrats from being able to cast their vote. This was Todd Alba. He was the chief of staff to a Republican state senator who I believe was the majority leader in the Wisconsin state Senate at the time. And, said that they were gleeful. And he said that's why he eventually left the Republican Party entirely. He went on to be interviewed by Zachary Roth at MSNBC after he had put out his Facebook. And we read his entire Facebook post on this. The guy now runs a coffee shop, and one of his employees was unable to vote in Wisconsin on April 5th because of the new ID law. One of his employees who had a driver's license, had a photo ID driver's license, but it was from a different state. He hadn't yet got his driver's license, I believe, as it was in the state of Wisconsin. He was therefore unable to vote despite being a properly registered voter and so forth. So Alba was talking about Republicans being gleeful about this. He quoted to MSNBC, he quoted another Republican. He said Grothman was one of the folks who was in that room. The guy you just heard, he was one of the folks who was in that room that day when they were talking about passing this law. He said another senator had said, quote, "What I'm interested in here is winning, and we need to use the opportunity, because if Democrats had the power to do it to us, they'd do it," said Alba. He said, "I was in the room when this thing was conceived and birthed." He said, "Some bills work differently in reality than they were intended. This one worked exactly as intended," unquote. Now, Grothman, for his part, later on went on to say, "Well, I just don't think that Alba is remembering that correctly. That's just not true. It's false. I didn't say anything like that. I would have never said anything like this." Well, now Todd Alba has said the same thing under oath in a case in Wisconsin. This is the former staffer to a Wisconsin state Republican senator who went public last month with these accusations, testified in a court case in Wisconsin under oath in federal court last week. And he identified both Grothman and a number of the other legislators by name: Mary Lazich, Glenn Grothman, Lee Vukmer, Randy Hopper, as being, quote, "giddy" in a 2001 private caucus meeting about passing that bill, according to the Journal Sentinel. So that's where we are. He said, according to Alba's testimony last week, Grothman said at that 2011 meeting, quote, "What I'm concerned about here is winning, and that's what really matters. We better get this done quickly while we have the opportunity." That's what Alba has now testified that Grothman said. Is there any doubt that that's the reason why these type of laws are being passed? No, there is none. Not only is there no doubt, there is no evidence of the type of fraud, the only type of fraud that they could possibly be used to deter. That's polling place impersonation. And that just, it doesn't happen. Why? Because it's the dumbest way to defraud an election. There are a lot of much smarter ways to do it other than, standing in line for who knows how long, giving someone's name who may or may not have voted already, who knows, and then casting a single vote. And yet, this is what the Republicans are doing because they realize if they can shave off just a few points, it may be enough to win any particular county and therefore state and therefore, in a presidential election, the White House. And that's what the Republicans are hoping for up in Virginia, where Democrats have sued to stop a law that was passed by the majority Republican legislators and signed into law by the state's then Republican governor. That Republican governor, by the way, is now Governor Bob McDonnell. He was found guilty of corruption charges, and he's now challenging that finding to the Supreme Court. But late last week, a federal judge upheld Virginia's photo ID requirement, dealing a blow to a national push by Democrats to remove those laws that they say, no, they don't say, they know, disenfranchise minority and poor voters. Republicans applauded the decision by the federal court, calling it a victory for the integrity of Virginia's elections, while Democrats called it a disappointment and said they will probably appeal. That's going on in Virginia, which is, again, another very important swing state for Democrats and Republicans alike this November. If nothing changes now, it's going to be a lot harder for voters to vote in Virginia, particularly Democratic-leaning voters in the state of Virginia. The Republican-controlled state legislature had approved that requirement back in 2013. It was signed into law by Virginia's Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe, his predecessor, Bob McDonald. They now have a Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe. But this law is already passed. It cannot be undone, at least until there's a Democratic legislature. Yes, elections matter, as Desi said, as I've said, even those off-year elections. And so this is just one of the reasons that I warned Democrats who are giddy about Donald Trump that there is likely to be a battle royale for access to the polls across the country this year. Our electoral system is remarkably brittle. It can be easily gamed both before and after votes are cast and then when they're counted. So, you know, and anyone who recalls our coverage on this program of the incredibly close Virginia Attorney General's election back in 2013, it was a matter of a few couple hundred votes. Anyone who remembers that can testify to how close these elections can be, how close they can be in states like Virginia, which is a very, very important state for Democrats to win this fall. Elections have consequences, including those off-year elections in Virginia and elsewhere, and Democrats are likely to pay the price for that off-year election. By the way, speaking of Virginia, Governor Terry McAuliffe, we may have this more on this in the future. He's now the Democratic governor. CNN is now reporting just before air that McAuliffe, the Democratic governor, is now the subject of an ongoing investigation by the FBI and prosecutors from the Justice Department's Public Integrity Unit. This, they say, is concerning among the things they're looking at, campaign finance donations, one of which includes $120,000 from a Chinese businessman. Although this Chinese businessman is now supposedly a permanent U.S. resident, which makes him a U.S. person who under election laws are eligible to donate to McAuliffe's campaign. So we will see what goes on there with McAuliffe. He is a big supporter of Hillary Clinton's. He was a former head of the DNC. So we will see what happens. In the meantime, more and more Republicans are, in fact, coming around to Donald Trump. Remember months ago when Lindsey Graham, when he was running for the Republican nomination, remember when he was talking about what would happen if the only choices at that point were Donald Trump and Ted Cruz?
If you nominate Trump and Cruz, I think you get the same outcome. You know, whether it's death by being shot or poisoning, does it really matter?
Yeah. Well, that was Lindsey Graham. And he has been saying over and over again how Donald Trump was not a real conservative. He said it recently again on CNN.
I just don't believe Donald Trump is a reliable conservative Republican. And I don't think he has the temperament or judgment to be commander in chief. I just can't go there with Donald.
And I just really believe that the Republican Party has been conned here, and this guy is not a reliable conservative Republican.
Oh, that's what he said over and over again, Lindsey Graham. He just he's conned. Donald Trump is a con man. He's not a real conservative. It's the comparison between being shot or poisoned. He said that over and over. Here he is again on CNN.
I would have supported Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. I just can't go where Donald Trump takes the party and the country. I'm sorry I can't. I respect those who will go there, but I can't go where Mr. Trump takes us.
Well, funny thing about that, Senator Lindsey Graham, one of his fiercest critics, is now calling on Republicans to support the presumptive nominee. Imagine that. Who could have told you that was going to happen? CNN also is reporting that Graham urged GOP donors at a private fundraiser over the weekend in Florida to unite behind Donald Trump's campaign and stress the importance of keeping likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton from the White House. Reports CNN, the fundraiser was hosted by a former U.S. ambassador, a former Republican National Committee finance chairman who also chaired Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential bid. Teresa Daly, a prominent Florida Republican fundraiser who attended the private event, told CNN on Sunday, quote, "He did say that we need to get behind him." Yes, even Lindsey Graham is saying they need to get behind Donald Trump. That is what the Republicans are going to do. So all of that is happening, as I warned you it would, at the same time that the polls continue to mount, showing some a very tough road here for Hillary Clinton. NBC News has a new poll out. NBC News Wall Street Journal poll over the weekend find that Clinton's lead over Trump nationally has now shrunk to just 3 points. 3 points, according to NBC. Clinton is 46 to Trump's 43. She's up 4 points since the last poll. She's down 4 points since the last poll. Donald Trump is up 4 points since the last poll. According to NBC Wall Street Journal, her unfavorable ratings, she's way underwater here, 21 points underwater. The only thing that's encouraging to her from that is that Donald Trump is even farther underwater in his favorable unfavorables by negative 29 points. And again, these aren't cherry-picked polls. This is now one after another. ABC News, Washington Post poll over the weekend. Some good news for Hillary Clinton. She's up 6 points. It's not a lot, but she's up 6 points among all adults nationally. But among registered voters, Donald Trump is now beating Hillary Clinton by 2 points, according to the Washington Post ABC News poll. Beating her 46 to 44. That is up 5 points for Donald Trump since March, and Hillary Clinton has slipped 6 points since March. Those are national. State polls, what about those? Because it's really only state polls that matter. Well, in Florida, according to the CBS Battleground poll, in Florida, Hillary Clinton is now beating Donald Trump by a single point, 43 to 42 in the important swing state of Florida. And in Ohio, she's doing a little bit better. She's up by 5 points there, 44 to 39. But this is not good news, I should say, for Hillary Clinton. It may be something that Democrats want to keep in mind as they get ready for another set of primary elections coming up in 2 weeks out here in California and out in New Jersey, North Dakota, South Dakota, New Mexico, and Montana, and a few other places, Washington, D.C., and yet, you've got a lot of Democrats who are now freaking out that this thing is going on so long, that this race continues, that, oh, they say it's hurting Hillary Clinton. That's why she's doing poorly in the polls. She's because, you know, this fight between her and Bernie Sanders. Well, evidence shows that's not the case either. This from the same NBC News poll that I just read to you earlier. Despite evidence that the still ongoing Democratic primary has taken a toll on Hillary Clinton's poll numbers, Democrats, by a 2-to-1 margin, believe that the Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders contest, if that lasts through June, they say it is helpful to the party. According to this latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, 40% of Democratic primary voters say that the Democratic race continuing through the final primaries in June is good for the party. That versus 22% who think it's bad. 40% think it's good for the Democratic Party, 22% think it's bad for the Democratic Party, 36% think it makes no difference either way. That is different from back in 2008, when around the same time, the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll showed that just 21% believed that the long fight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton was good for the party. 21% thought it was good, compared with 37% who thought it was bad at the time. Those numbers are now flipped in this contest between Sanders and Clinton, but not everyone agrees. And we will take a quick break and come back and talk with Harold Meyerson about exactly that and about, you know, what damage, if any, Bernie Sanders supporters may be doing to the Democrats' chances in this primary and this November against Donald Trump. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Are Bernie bros undermining Democrats' chances? We'll talk about that next with Harold Meyerson. I'm Brad. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Following the chaotic state Democratic convention in Nevada just over a week ago, where Sanders supporters vociferously protested parliamentary procedures by the state party chair, which left many of them unable to challenge or introduce rules amendments or contest a disputed voice vote, many in the corporate media misreported what happened at the convention as violence by Sanders supporters. That included, they said, the throwing of chairs at the stage, etc. While no chairs were actually shown to have been thrown at the stage or anywhere else, and there was no evidence of violence at the convention, the proceedings did get loud and raucous, and in the days following it, some who were claiming to be Sanders supporters outrageously left threatening voicemail and text messages for the state party chair in Nevada, the one who had gaveled the convention in Las Vegas to a premature close amidst those chaotic protests. But even though the chair-throwing nonsense has been pretty thoroughly debunked by NPR and others since then, the damage was done, including by outlets like NPR themselves, who had inaccurately reported on it originally. Folks like the Green Party's presidential candidate Jill Stein described on this program last week that the incident has been made into what she called the Dean Scream of 2016, as it's been used by the corporate media to unfairly damage the Sanders campaign, just as upstart Howard Dean's Democratic presidential campaign was undermined by the corporate media, using a video of Dean giving a rallying cry to supporters as a way to undermine the seriousness of his campaign back in 2004. But even some longtime Sanders supporters, real ones, not just Democrats who call themselves progressive but who always supported Hillary Clinton anyway, real ones, real Sanders supporters, some of them are now charging that the behavior of some of Sanders' loudest proponents may now be undermining the Vermont senator's surprisingly successful run for the Democratic Party nomination, and further, that a failure by those Sanders proponents to support Hillary Clinton this November, if she finally secures the nomination, will actually harm Bernie Sanders, his agenda, and his call for a political revolution in the future. One of those longtime Sanders supporters concerned about the effect of some of Sanders' most ardent proponents is Harold Meyerson, who explained his concerns in his column at The Prospect last week, headlined "How the Bros Are Undermining Bernie." Until late last year, Harold Meyerson was a longtime weekly columnist for The Washington Post, and for many years prior to that, he served as executive editor for the LA Weekly Out Here. He is now the executive editor of the American Prospect magazine and contributes to the Los Angeles Times and other national publications. I believe this is his first time on the Bradcast. Harold Meyerson, sir, welcome to the Bradcast.
Great to be here, Brad.
Delighted to have you, sir. All right, over the last several days, really weeks on this program, We've been doing our best to counter the corporate mainstream narrative, which has essentially declared Hillary Clinton to be the nominee before the process is even over. For example, out here in California, I would like to be able to cast my vote, all of our votes, with some, you know, 475 pledged delegates up for grabs. And not to mention New Jersey, North Dakota, South Dakota, etc. Before being told that it's over by the media, it would be nice for those of us to be able to vote. But with all of that in mind, you offered at least two historical cases that I think are really important to support your argument that many of the Bernie or bust supporters out there might want to keep in mind. Before you explain them, let's check your Bernie bona fides here. You're not a Hillary bot. You're not a Hillary bro, right? You're a lifelong Democratic
right.
socialist.
I am indeed.
And you describe it that there was a time that you and Bernie were really the only ones in D.C. willing to admit you were lifelong Democratic socialists.
Yeah, I think I wrote a column about in the Post about 7 or 8 years ago, I'm not quite sure when, in which I said the only two Democratic socialists I know in Washington are Senator Bernie Sanders and the guy I see in the mirror every morning when I shave. I've been around this... this business, such as it is, for a very long time, and I'm tremendously excited by the Sanders campaign. I mean, I think he has. I've written in the Prospect in the last print issue mm-hmm. that it isn't so much that he invented a left as that he revealed it. That there was this absolute, legitimate, real frustration and discontent with both the economic system and the political system that that bolsters the economic system, and that we're seeing it in all kinds of ways this year, in good ways and to a certain degree in bad ways, with to the extent that it has fed some of the stuff we see in the Donald Trump campaign and that we see in right-wing populist parties in Europe, but that Sanders has done a tremendous service, and what's really crucial is that the forces that he has put into action continue to operate and can continue to push the limits of the possible in the United States once his campaign is over, whether that is in July or in November.
But now, Harold Meyerson, you are turning on your comrade. You make the case, at least in your column at The Prospect last week, that Sanders supporters are now actually undermining, at least some of them, at least many of them, as you argue, are now undermining Sanders and his campaign. How so?
Well, some of them. I didn't say many of them.
Okay, fair
enough.
No,
I just think that, I agree with you that there was massive misreporting of what went on in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
But just, you know, the tweets and the texts and the trolling that goes on among some of his supporters, a really distinct minority, I should add, it doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in focusing to a degree on the Democratic Party and its rules, which they need to do because they need to be changed,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, we need to remember the greater goal and the greater narrative of really changing economic and political power in this country. And that's the main goal here. And while there are legitimate distinctions between the Sanders and the Clinton camp, we should also remember that there are a lot of lefties in the Clinton camp too. I noticed today each campaign made their appointments today, Monday, to mm-hmm. the Democratic Party's the convention's platform a drafting committee.
Right.
And among the non-Sanders appointees are people like Barbara Lee, who's probably, you know, the leftmost member of the House,
mm-hmm.
member of Congress from Oakland, with a record at least as left as Bernie's. This needs to be a nuanced critique, and sometimes where our guys are lacking in nuance, you know. It's very frequent in politics
yes.
that people on your side ain't as nuanced as you would have them. But you know, I think they need to be reminded now and then of keeping their eyes on the prize, as it were.
And let's do some of that. Let's remind folks of that, because I think that a lot of the institutional memory out here seems to be lost or ignored with the social media and the thinning out of the corporate mainstream media. So in your prospect column, you write that we have seen this all before. You draw a parallel to Sanders supporters now and what happened in the 1968 campaign. So when you had the party tearing itself apart because of opposition to the Vietnam War, talk to me and other youngsters like myself, Harold Meyerson, who may not remember what happened. Talk to me about the fissures in the Democratic Party at the time and the parallels you in 68 and the parallels you now see to 2016.
Yeah, well, I was a youngster in 1968. Literally, I just graduated L.A. High School, and L.A. High Schools in those days had mid-year graduation.
Mm-hmm.
So I graduated in January of 68, right before the Tet Offensive kind of exposed, and not that we weren't against the war to begin with, but expose the complete failure of the American effort in Vietnam to do anything but kill Vietnamese and Americans, and that there was an anti-war candidacy, initially Senator Eugene McCarthy, and then joined by Senator Robert Kennedy, all of which came to blows, as it were, at the Democratic Convention in 1968 in Chicago. Where again I was, the new revelations about how rotten the Chicago Police Department are,
mm-hmm.
are kind of, you know, we saw this already many decades ago. It's simply that nothing has changed in any event. But what happened thereafter was that the people of my generation and a little older who got active in the McCarthy and Kennedy and 4 years later the George McGovern campaign really stuck around and changed the Democratic Party, and they made it for some decades thereafter both generally more progressive and certainly more anti-interventionist and not crazy Cold War party that it had been from the end of World War II until the breakdown of the Vietnam War. So that was, that was a real achievement, but you know, it takes staying power. You don't change a political party by coming in and then going out. I mean, these people ran essentially anti-war candidates for a number of, for any number of political positions in the years thereafter. And just as you would hope, I would hope that the Sanders campaign generates a lot of people who are, want a more democratic and equitable economy and society and stick around after the Sanders campaign is over this year.
But you also made the case that it was those divisions within the Democratic Party that led to Richard Nixon winning that year and, the war continuing on for years thereafter. You write that if the Sanders revolution is ever to come to fruition, the Bernie brigades will have to vote for and work for Hillary Clinton's election in the fall. Why is that important when so many Sanders supporters find Hillary Clinton's policies to be abhorrent?
Well, I mean, you have in two ways. First of all, a Clinton administration is going to be pressured from the left by Bernie, by Elizabeth Warren, by all of the people who were active in the Sanders campaign, by the unions. But, the way to pressure it is to elect representatives, which God knows is certainly capable of doing, who represent, the Sanders politics in subsequent primaries. But, you're going to need support from some of the Hillary backers to do that. And, one of the most interesting things, if you look at the exit polling and other polling this year, is that a substantial, and I've seen this, in campaign event after campaign event, a substantial number of Hillary supporters actually back a lot of Bernie's proposals, and they're with Hillary out of, whatever strategic or tactical considerations they have made. So it's a mistake. First of all, I think it's just empirically wrong to label a lot of those people as your political opponents. And secondly, a lot of those people can be mobilized on behalf of, Sanders-esque candidates for congressional, Senate, and other seats. So you wouldn't want to estrange them. And you get more power lobbying Hillary to move left then ultimately you have to join forces with the Clinton people too. If Trump is president, opposing a power dive into racist neo-fascism or fascist neo-racism or whatever it is that Donald mm-hmm. Trump would represent if he's elected.
You also note another historical parallel in your article to this year's election, and which you warn about, that goes back to German communists, Stalin, and the Nazis in the 1930s. Explain that compelling parallel, because it actually is a really interesting parallel for those who are thinking it'd be better to have Trump.
Right. This is kind of the, if you're looking at strategic errors of the communist movement, I think this probably ranks right up there. There was this period in the late 20s and early 30s as Stalin consolidated his power in the Soviet Union, where they tended to label as their main enemies the party closest to them, because they wanted to eliminate the rivalry. So in this case, in Germany, it was the German Social Democrats who had been the traditional left party, and then the communists emerged after 1919. They called them social fascists, which is a kind of nonsensical term, but and mainly campaigned against them rather than Hitler in the 1932 elections, which the Nazis won enough votes to form a government. This was, a mistake that the communists later realized they should not have made. I think labeling the Hillary people as, the main enemy is a kind of grim. I hear a little echo in there of labor labeling the Social Democrats as social fascists. You can be outside a political tendency or close to it, but not of it,
mm-hmm.
Without labeling it as the main problem. And I think, for all of the limitations of Hillary Clinton, she is miles away from Donald Trump, and that should be obvious, just looking at his statements on race and immigration and et cetera and et cetera.
Harold Morrison, before I let you go, one question. Last week I reported on the 2008 Gallup poll that found 28% of Hillary Clinton supporters back in 2008 had planned to vote for John McCain if Obama won the nomination that year. That's almost the exact same number we're seeing now, claiming that they're going to not vote for Hillary or they're going to vote for Trump. Isn't all the worry that so many, we're hearing a lot of hand-wringing coming from, frankly, longtime Hillary supporters in the media, worried that, this continuing fight only helps Donald Trump. It seems like some of these folks needed a fainting couch after the lively protests in Nevada at the convention. Isn't this just democracy? Isn't this the way it works? Doesn't this all sort itself out after the voting is finally done?
Well, not automatically. I think Hillary will have to make some real concessions on platform, and I mm-hmm. think that'll be great. Push her to the left on the economy. So, she has to move some.
Mm-hmm.
Both candidates have to be open to some kind of resolution that recognizes
but the idea
the progressive
that the
movement of the Democratic Party. But, I agree with you that I think the number of Sanders supporters who ultimately will not vote for Hillary if she's the nominee and it comes down to her versus Trump, I think it's a lot smaller than we're seeing now. I think, confronting the reality of a Trump presidency will, concentrate the mind.
Well, we'll see. I think it will. We'll see. And, I like to see a lively democracy. That's kind of what this seems to me to be, even when there are, many people and many things they do that I don't agree with. I'm thinking, hey, that's democracy. Let the people vote. Let the process work its way through. In any event, check out Harold Meyerson's column and his work, as always, at prospect.org. The column we refer to is How the Bros Are Undermining Bernie. Harold Meyerson, great to talk to you, my friend. I really appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast.
It's a pleasure, Brad. Take care.
All right. You too. Since Harold mentioned that that platform committee that has now been, this is also broke just before air, Senator Bernie Sanders has been given an unusual say over the drafting of the Democratic Party platform this year. even if, as expected, he loses the primary contest to Hillary Clinton. That's Washington Post saying, as expected, not me. The two Democratic candidates have agreed with Democratic Party officials to a new apportionment of the 15-member committee that writes the platform. Clinton has picked 6 members and Sanders has named 5. These all used to be named by the DNC chair, but now they're allowing them to split it up. So indeed, Sanders has picked James Zogby, a pro-Palestinian activist, as the Washington Post put it. They were fixated on Zogby being chosen here. Also, Cornel West, liberal author and racial justice activist. He's been a Sanders surrogate. He's been named for the platform committee. Sanders also named Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota, a big backer of his, and environmental activist Bill McKibben. Desi Doyen, did you know that he was going to be on this platform committee?
Yes,
That's kind of cool.
And there's also one more who's been nominated by the Sanders campaign, a Native American activist.
That's right. Deborah Parker has been named. Harold Meyerson had mentioned Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She is the only woman or man in Congress to have voted against the 2001 authorization to go to war in Afghanistan. So for her to be on this committee, that's important as well. So all of these people are there because Bernie is in this race. And that's something I would suggest Democrats think about when they, you know, if they're going to say Bernie or bust and, you know, vote for Donald Trump or for a third party or stay home. If you want to be in the game, if you want to have, you know, folks like Cornel West and Barbara Lee and Bill McKibben affecting policy in the during a Clinton administration, if that's what comes about, well, I would think twice about that. That lesser of two evil arguments that we hear so much about from Sanders supporters who are considering not voting at all this November. Anyway, another quick thought about that after this break. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Bernie Sanders himself made the argument that it would be a contest between the lesser of two evils this fall when he was speaking, if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, when he was speaking over the weekend with George Stephanopoulos on ABC News This Week. He says he wasn't making that argument, but that a lot of voters felt that way.
We need a campaign, an election coming up, which does not have two candidates who are really very, very strongly disliked. I don't want to see the American people voting for the lesser of two evils. I want the American people to be voting for a vision of economic justice, of social justice, of environmental justice, of racial justice. That is the campaign we are running, and that's why we are getting the support we are.
Is that how you would describe Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump, the lesser of two evils?
Well, if you look, no, I wouldn't describe it, but that's what the American people are saying. If you look at the favorability ratings of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, both of them have very, very high unfavorables. You're not going to disagree
with
me on that.
There's no question about that. Absolutely.
Well, that was Bernie Sanders over the weekend talking about the choice as potentially being a choice between the lesser of two evils. That's a point that Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate in 2016, she was the nominee for the Greens in 2012. That's a point that she made as well on this program last week during my interview with her. In response to that, Eric B. writes to me at bradcast@bradblog.com to say, "Oi, I spent my formative years in post-war Germany. From my German friends, I learned much about what leads to disaster." Then he goes on to list them. 1, the lesser of two evils is, in all caps, less evil. Okay.
Simple math.
Good point. 2, total revolution leads to total chaos. Total chaos leads to fascism. Now, I don't think that Bernie Sanders is calling for total revolution. I think he's calling very carefully for a political revolution. But in any event, three, when the powers that be hold most of the cards, a direct confrontation is pointless. Four, if power is threatened, it will react with overwhelming brutality. Five, incrementalism is more successful in the long run as it helps preserve culture, economic stability, and lives. Six, history is not written by the winners. It is written by the survivors.
Ooh, wow.
He goes on to write, I do not want a revolution. There has never been a revolution that has not devastated real people's lives. One should remember that every signer of the Declaration of Independence died in poverty. I'm not sure that's true, by the way. Didn't Thomas Jefferson survive pretty well at Monticello? In any event, he says, and the American Revolution is supposed to be the template for a good revolution. I have reservations about its goodness. Again, that was an actual violent revolution. Bernie Sanders is calling for a political revolution, which is very different. In any event, that's the note signed by Eric B. in Long Beach, California, who adds that he is Bernie in the primary, Hillary in the general, though I may have to eat dry toast to prevent vomiting.
Oh.
That's what he says.
But well written, my goodness.
Well writ. Thanks for that letter, Eric B. You can send me email anytime yourself if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Use hashtag Bradcast. My thanks today to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, to the prospects, Harold Meyerson, and of course to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, go listen to that interview with Jill Stein. It was quite interesting. You can find it at bradblog.com. And over at iTunes, you can download all our shows for free at any of those places anytime. All right.
And please leave us a nice recommendation because it really, really does help other
people find
us.
Helps other people find us, yeah.
That's how word gets out.
Give us a nice review over at iTunes. And while you're there, give the Green News Report a good review too.
Please.
Desi needs it. All right. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.